Imagine waking up in a cold sweat, right? You're lying in this bed in a stone fortress,
Oh boy, yeah, here we go.
and you have zero memory, like completely blank on the last 12 hours of your life.
Nothing at all.
Exactly. You look down at your hand, and there's this heavy, unfamiliar emerald ring on your finger.
Sitting there.
Right. And then beside you on the nightstand, there's a legally binding marriage document.
Signed by the High Priestess, no less.
Yeah, declaring you the Duchess of Tirindor and the man you love, the guy who just secretly orchestrated this entire, clandestine, memory-wiped wedding, he's just gone.
Vanished.
He left a hastily scribbled note that just says, "Don't look for me, it's yours now."
I mean, it is arguably one of the most destabilizing cliffhangers in modern fantasy.
It's wild.
It really is sitting right there on the final page of Onyx Storm. It completely, it just recontextualizes the entire political and magical landscape of the series in a single stroke.
And that is the exact level of narrative whiplash we are dealing with today.
Yeah.
Because you are walking into a romantasy trivia night.
And not just any trivia night.
No, a trivia night focused on Rebecca Yarros's The Empyrean series. And let's not sugarcoat this, okay? The stakes at these events are ruthless.
Oh, they take no prisoners.
Seriously,
Yeah.
you aren't just trying to remember, like, the capital of a Midwestern state. You are walking onto the parapet.
That's a great way to put it.
You are staring down a trivia host who is actively trying to trick you with, obscure tale types of secondary dragons.
The tale types always get people.
Or the deeply intertwined geopolitical histories of these fictional warring nations. I mean, we're talking about roughly 2,400 pages of lore.
Spread across three massive books.
Yeah. And the questions are explicitly engineered to expose the casual readers.
Well, and the sheer density of the world building is exactly where teams falter under pressure.
Right.
Because, I mean, anyone can remember that Violet rides a black dragon, you know?
Sure, that's easy.
But very few people can articulate the actual thermodynamic differences between a writer's signet and a Venian's draw.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Or even the exact chronological pacing of the romantic tension across the chapters. To dominate a trivia environment of that caliber, a superficial reading just isn't going to cut it.
No way. Which is why the goal for this deep dive today is to strip away the filler.
Exactly.
We want to isolate the core mechanics, the character psychologies, and the tactical realities that actually drive the plot. Consider this your ultimate tactical briefing.
Get your notebooks out.
We are going to arm you with the conceptual frameworks you need to not just answer the questions, but to understand why the answers are what they are.
Because when you understand the engine of the world, right, the trivia just becomes second nature.
Totally. But we do have to lay down a massive kingdom-wide spoiler warning right now.
Yes, huge spoiler
We
warning.
are covering everything up to and including the jaw-dropping fallout of Book 3, Onyx Storm.
We are holding absolutely nothing back.
So if anyone on your trivia team isn't fully caught up, like, send them out of the room right now. Put headphones on.
Definitely. So, to build that conceptual framework, I think we have to begin with the fundamental laws of physics and magic in this universe.
Right, the absolute basics.
Yeah, because the geopolitics, the rebellion, even the romance, none of it operates independently of the magic system. The conflict between Navarre and Poramiel is the scaffolding for the entire narrative.
And the big trivia trap here is viewing this as a standard, good kingdom versus bad kingdom setup.
Right, it's way more complicated.
Navarre is Violet's home. It's this militaristic, highly isolated nation that's walled off behind these massive magical wards.
And their absolute supremacy is built entirely on dragons.
Exactly. Whereas Poromiel is their neighbor, the so-called ancient enemy. But Poromiel relies on gryphons, not dragons.
Which is a huge difference.
Massive. The physics of the magic system dictate that gryphons simply cannot channel the same sheer volume of power that dragons can. Gryphon riders wield inherently weaker magic.
And that power imbalance has sustained a border war for so many centuries that, the citizens of Navarre just treat the conflict like background weather. It's just always there.
Yeah, it's just a fact of life for them.
But that disparity in magical conduit strength is the key. Navarre's military advantage is so overwhelming that it allows them to maintain a society built on extreme, unquestioned hierarchy.
Centered right around the Bastiath War College.
Exactly. And trivia hosts frequently target the structural organization of Bastiath.
Oh, for sure.
The college operates on four strict tracks or quadrants. You have the scribes, the healers, the infantry, and the writers.
And the friction for the whole story starts immediately. because Violet Soaringale, you know, our narrator, she is biologically and psychologically built to be a scribe.
100%.
She's fragile. She suffers from this chronic illness that causes her joints to literally dislocate under stress.
Which is terrifying in a war college.
Right. She was raised among books, just analyzing history and translating texts. But her mother, General Lilith Soaringale, who happens to be the commanding officer of the college, forces her into the Writer's Quadrant.
Which is basically a death sentence.
Yeah, the attrition rate in the Writer's Quadrant is not a metaphor. The enrollment process alone is crossing a narrow, rain-slick stone bridge hundreds of feet in the air called the parapet.
If you slip, you die.
And the military just considers it a successful weeding out of the weak. It's so brutal.
It is. So Violet's survival depends entirely on her intellect. Because she lacks the physical durability of her peers, she has to understand the magical mechanics on, like, a molecular level.
She has to outsmart the system.
Exactly. And this brings us to the core of the magic system, which is a vital area for trivia. Humans in this universe do not possess inherent magic.
Not at all.
Right. They cannot generate power on their own. They must pull magic through their bonded dragon.
The dragon is the conduit.
Yeah. The dragon taps into the ambient magic of the world and safely channels a fraction of it into the human writer.
And once that bond is formed, two distinct things manifest. And you really cannot confuse these terms at the trivia table, folks.
Oh, they will definitely try to trip you up on this.
First, the writer receives a relic. This is a physical, permanent, tattoo-like mark that appears on the writer's skin, and it symbolizes the specific dragon they bonded.
Right, that's the relic.
Second, the writer manifests the signet. The signet is the actual magical power.
The ability itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The magic is drawn from the dragon. But the shape that power takes, that's dictated by the writer's core personality and their deepest needs.
And the established law of Navarre is one dragon, one relic, one signet per writer. The entire system is predicated on that mathematical limitation.
Till Violet comes along.
Right. Violet completely shatters this framework at threshing.
Remind everybody what threshing is.
Threshing is the ceremony where the dragons select their writers. So Violet bonds Tairn, this legendary, massive, black, morning star-tailed dragon who hasn't bonded in years.
Which already paints a huge target on her back.
Oh, yeah. But she simultaneously bonds Endana, who at the time appears to be this helpless, golden, feather-tail hatchling.
And bonding two dragons is unprecedented.
Oh.
It overloads her system with so much raw power that her primary signet manifests as lightning wielding.
Which is incredibly rare.
Yeah, it's one of the most lethal destructive powers in existence. She basically becomes a walking artillery strike.
She really does.
But, you know, mastering writer magic is only half of the equation you need for trivia. To really understand why Navarre is so militarized, you have to understand the existential threat they're hiding from their own people.
The true enemy.
Exactly. The Venin.
And the dichotomy between writers and Venin is the philosophical and magical axis of the entire series. A trivia host will absolutely probe your understanding of this difference.
So pay attention here.
The mechanics of Venin magic represent a fundamental corruption of the natural order.
Let's break this down tactically, because I think analogy works best here. Being a writer is like drawing electricity through a heavy-duty surge protector.
I like that.
The dragon is the surge protector. The world is full of this immense, unbridled, magical energy, and the dragon regulates that flow so it doesn't instantly incinerate the human nervous system.
You get a controlled, usable amount of power.
Right. Becoming a Venin, on the other hand, is like deciding the surge protector isn't giving you enough juice, so you just strip the wires and plug your bare hands directly into a nuclear reactor.
That analogy holds up perfectly, especially when you look at the physiological consequences. Venin bypass the dragon conduit entirely. They forcibly draw magic straight out of the earth.
Just ripping it out.
Yeah, and the power ceiling disappears. A Venin can pull as much magic as they want, granting them godlike destructive capabilities. But the toll on the environment and the human body is catastrophic.
Because it is a one-way street, the second you bypass the conduit and pull from the earth, your hardware is permanently corrupted.
There's no going back.
No. You drain the land around you into dead gray dust, just destroying the ecosystem. And internally, you hollow out your own soul. You literally lose your humanity.
It's so dark.
And the psychological trap is brilliant because it's usually born of desperation, not just some evil ambition.
Right. People turn Venin when they need more power than their dragon can provide.
Usually to save someone they love.
Right.
But once they take that hit, the magic just consumes them.
And Yaros is weaving a very deliberate metaphor here about environmental exploitation and, you know, the illusion of infinite resources.
Oh, for sure.
The Venan are consuming the literal life force of the planet for immediate selfish gain, leaving barren wastelands behind. They are a parasitic force.
Yeah.
And Navarre's military has spent centuries studying them, classifying them into a distinct hierarchy that trivia players absolutely must memorize.
Okay, yes. You have to know the four ranks.
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom, you have the initiates. These are the people who just made the choice to draw from the earth.
The newbies, basically.
Yeah, and the telltale sign is the red rings around their eyes,
yeah,
which fluctuate. They haven't fully saturated their systems yet.
Right. Then, moving up the chain of command, you encounter the Asim. At this stage, the corruption has taken a much deeper root.
It's permanent now.
Yeah, their eyes are permanently red, and when they channel or become agitated, their veins visibly distend and darken under the skin.
Then we get to the sages. The sages are the recruiters and the battlefield commanders.
They're terrifying.
Their eyes are red, but the corruption is so severe that they have these permanent, dark, spiderweb-like veins spread right across their faces.
And the trivia name to keep in your back pocket here is Berwyn.
Berwyn, yes.
He's a prominent sage you encounter in the text.
At the apex of the hierarchy are the Maven. These are the mythic generals of the Venan forces. The lore within the War College actually states that a Maven has never been captured alive.
Which tells you how powerful they are.
Theophany is the key Maven introduced during the climax of Onyx Storm. So remember that name, Theophany.
But we have to differentiate the Venan from their foot soldiers because this is a classic, classic trivia trap.
Oh, people mess this up all the time.
Teams constantly use the words Venan and Wyvern interchangeably, and they are completely different entities.
Totally different.
Venan are the people, the corrupted magic users who draw from the earth. Wyvern are the abominations the Venan create.
Yeah, Wyvern are basically biological drones. They are massive, two-legged creatures engineered to resemble dragons, but they possess zero inherent magic, no intelligence, and no ability to communicate.
They're mindless.
They're simply animated meat puppets powered by the Venan's magic, designed to just overwhelm enemy lines through sheer numbers.
And because of that, the combat tactics for defeating them are entirely separate. Because Wyvern are just magical constructs acting like vicious animals, you can put them down like animals.
Right.
If Violet hits a Wyvern with enough lightning, or a rider takes off its head with a broadsword, it dies. Physical trauma works.
But Venan, however, are practically immortal against standard attacks.
Yeah, standard weaponry might temporarily incapacitate a Venan, but their bodies regenerate rapidly due to the earth magic coursing through them.
So how do you kill them?
The only reliable method of execution is striking them with a blade forged from a highly specific, rare alloy.
And that alloy can only be produced using an intensely guarded magical furnace known as a luminary. Without an alloy dagger, engaging a Venan is pretty much a death sentence. Which begs the ultimate geopolitical question. If the Venan are this powerful, and Navarre's leadership has known about them for centuries, why the massive cover-up?
Right.
Why bury the truth so deeply that your own cadets don't even believe Venan exist outside of fairy tales? Navarre just sits behind its magical wards and lets Poromiel, its neighbor, get absolutely slaughtered.
Well, the existence of the wards forces Navarre's hand. The magical barrier surrounding Navarre wasn't built to keep Poromish griffin riders out.
Right.
It was engineered specifically to repel Venan. The wards nullify Venan magic. If Navarre's high command admits to the populace that Venan are real and that the wards are the only barrier preventing an apocalyptic invasion,
then they have to admit that the hundreds of years of war with Poromiel is a fabricated lie.
Exactly.
They've been drafting generations of cadets to go die on the border, telling the public they are defending Navarre's resources from Poromish aggression.
When the horrifying reality is that Poromiel isn't an aggressor at all.
They are a desperate nation of refugees. They are being actively eaten alive by the Venan, and they're attacking Navarre's borders, just trying to get inside the wards to survive.
It's awful. Navarre basically locked the bunker, turned on the electric fence, and watched the rest of the continent burn.
All while spinning this massive propaganda campaign to justify their isolationism.
And maintaining a conspiracy of that magnitude requires a society built on absolute draconian control. You cannot tolerate a single dissenting voice when your entire civilization is sitting on a powder keg of lies.
The military have to be ruthless.
And that leads us to the most brutal chapter of Navarre's recent history, which really sets up the entire conflict of the series, the suppression of the Tirish Rebellion.
Yeah, you have to know the history here for trivia. A faction within Navarre, centered in the province of Tirindor, actually discovered the truth about the Vinnin and tried to secede to help Poromiel.
They wanted to do the right thing.
Right. This rebellion was led by a man named Fenrirsen.
And the Navarre military response was swift and uncompromising. Violet's mother, General Lilith Sorengale, was instrumental in crushing the uprising.
She led the charge.
The rebel officers, including Fenrirsen, were captured and publicly executed. But the true psychological warfare was how they handled the families.
This is so messed up.
Fen's son, Zayden Rierson, who obviously becomes the central male figure of the series, was forced to stand and watch his father be put to death.
The military didn't just kill the leaders. They targeted the children. There were 107 children of the executed rebel officers. They became known as the Marked Ones.
The Marked Ones, remember that term?
As a permanent visual punishment, a dragon burned a shimmering rebellion relic into the skin of every single one of those children.
It's this twisting pattern moving up their wrists.
Yeah, and they were dispersed into loyalist foster homes, and a decree was passed. Upon coming of age, every Marked One was conscripted into the Lethal Riders Squadron.
Because the Riders Squadron is essentially a meat grinder. The leadership calculated that the environmental hazards, the brutal training, and the dragons themselves would simply eliminate the children over time.
It's a slow execution.
Exactly. It effectively wipes out the rebel bloodlines without the bad optics of executing minors.
Okay, but I'm going to push back on this heavily right now. Because sitting at a trivia table, thinking through the logic of this world, Navarre's strategy seems incredibly flawed.
You think so?
It crosses the line from ruthless to just plain arrogant. You take 107 children, you murder their parents in front of them, you brand them, and then you force them into the one military branch where the survivors are rewarded with dragons.
Well, when you put it like that,
you are handing literal weapons of mass destruction to the teenagers who have the most motivation to overthrow your government. It is a strategic disaster waiting to happen.
It does seem that way.
I mean, Zayden Rierson survives. He bonds one of the most powerful dragons in existence. And now you have a deeply traumatized, highly motivated rebel leader with a tactical nuke at his disposal inside your own walls. Okay, from a purely tactical standpoint, it seems suicidal. I'll give you that. However, you have to view this through the lens of political theater and fascist control.
Okay, lay it on me.
Navarre's leadership isn't just trying to kill the kids. They're trying to break the concept of rebellion in the minds of the public. If they just execute the kids, they create martyrs.
Right.
By forcing them into the Riders Squadron, if the children fail and die, it's chalked up to the natural selection of the college. But if they succeed and bond a dragon, the military has successfully assimilated them.
Because a bonded rider has to serve Navarre.
Exactly. It's the ultimate display of state power. Taking the children of your enemies and turning them into your most lethal weapons.
But they must have known the risk of an uprising from within the ranks was astronomical. These kids absolutely hate them. They accepted that risk because they believed they had an infallible security measure in place.
Oh, right. Melgrin.
Yes. The entire leadership structure of Navarre rests their confidence on one individual. General Melgrin. He is the commanding general of the armed forces, and he rides a massive black sword tail named Coda.
And Melgrin's signet makes rebellion theoretically impossible.
Because he possesses absolute precognition in warfare. He can see the outcome of any battle before the first sword is even drawn.
Melgrin can view the branching timelines of conflict. Like, if Zayden or any of the Marked Ones even planned a localized strike against a Navarre outpost, Melgrin would see the defeat in his mind's eye days in advance.
And he'd just deploy forces to neutralize the threat before it materialized.
You literally cannot stage an insurrection against an omniscient general.
That is exactly why they felt comfortable arming the Marked Ones. Melgrin's precognition was their absolute safety net.
But the magic system in Yaros' universe always demands balance. And this brings us to the most brilliant trivia mechanism in the series. The ultimate loophole.
The blind spot.
Yes. Think about the physical marks on the 107 children. The rebellion relics. Which dragon actually breathed the fire to create those marks?
It was General Melgrin's own dragon, Coda.
Right.
The dragon who provides the magic for the precognition signet is the exact same dragon who marked the rebel children.
And magic interacting with its own source creates interference. Think of General Melgrin's precognition as a highly advanced military radar system sweeping the continent for threats.
Okay.
Because Coda's magic created the rebellion relics, those relics act like a localized EMP against Melgrin's signet. The golden rule you must memorize for trivia is this. Whenever three or more marked ones gather in close physical proximity, General Melgren's precognition is completely blinded.
The magic just cancels itself out.
They vanish from his radar entirely. He cannot see the outcome of any action they take.
And this interference forces Navarre to pass a very specific, strange civilian law, making it highly illegal for three or more marked ones to congregate in one place.
Just standing next to each other is a crime.
Yeah, the official propaganda states it's to prevent them from conspiring or forming gangs. But the classified truth is that Navarre is terrified of that blind spot.
And that blind spot is the entire foundation of the plot. It is the only reason Zaiden Ryerson is able to coordinate a massive underground resistance network, you know, smuggling weapons to Poromiel right under the noses of the Navarre leadership.
As long as Zaiden keeps his inner circle of marked ones physically close to him, the omniscient general is completely in the dark.
Which is so smart.
It is. And the tactical composition of Zaiden's inner circle is frequent trivia fodder. You really need to map out the key marked ones operating within the college.
Okay, let's list them.
Zaiden is the architect, of course. His second-in-command is his closest friend, Garrick.
Right.
You also have his cousin, Bodhi, who shares a striking physical resemblance to Zaiden. There is Imogen, easily identifiable by her pink hair and fiercely protective nature. And then there is Liam.
Oh, Liam. Liam, Mary, that is one of the most heartbreaking arcs in the series.
Liam's death during the climax of Book One at the Battle of Rhysand is the narrative fulcrum of the series.
It changes everything.
Until that moment, Violet understands the rebellion on an intellectual level. But Liam's death makes it visceral. It destroys the illusion of her safety and forces her to confront the reality that the war is not a distant concept. It is actively killing the people she loves.
In this deep-seated political and historical friction, Violet, the fragile daughter of the general who executed the rebels, and Zaiden, the hardened son of the rebel leader, it creates this massive powder keg.
A huge one.
And this brings us to the central thesis of the Empyrean. The romance isn't a subplot happening alongside the war. The romance is the plot.
Exactly.
The political revelations, the betrayals, the unearthing of Navarre's history, all of it is paced and triggered by the evolving trust dynamic between Violet and Zaiden.
Because the architecture of their relationship is literally hardwired into the biological imperatives of the magic system. They begin as mortal enemies. Zaiden has every historical justification to kill Violet the moment she steps onto the parapet.
But he can't kill her. And even if he wanted to ignore her, the universe won't let him.
Nope.
Let's look at the dragons. Violet rides Tairn. Zaiden rides Scale, an incredibly vicious navy blue dagger tail. And Tairn and Scale are a mated pair.
And the bond between mated dragons goes far beyond mere affection, right? It is a physiological necessity.
Yeah.
The lore establishes that mated dragons operate almost as a single biological entity. If they are separated by too much distance for an extended period, they experience severe physical and psychological degradation.
It can literally be lethal.
Yeah. And because human riders share an intimate mental and physical link with their dragons, whatever the dragons feel, the riders feel.
It's the ultimate forced proximity trope, but it's weaponized by the magic system. Mm-hmm. You have two people who represent completely opposite sides of a bloody political conflict, and the dragons essentially tell them, you have to stand in the same room on a regular basis or our nervous systems will collapse.
The magic enforces their interaction.
And over the course of Book One, that forced proximity chips away at Violet's indoctrination. She realizes Zaiden isn't the monster her mother warned her about.
He's actually deploying his people to protect her. He assigns Liam to be her shadow.
The paradigm shift really occurs when Violet is exposed to the world outside the wards, though.
During the war games.
Yeah. Zaiden's squad is manipulated into traveling to the Athabine outpost, which leads directly to the Battle of Rhysand. This is where Violet's worldview shatters.
She comes face to face with the Vinin and the Wyvern.
She realizes her entire education was state-sponsored propaganda and that the rebel Zaiden is actually running a desperate supply chain to keep innocent people from being slaughtered.
To understand the weight of Zaiden's character, though, the narrative heavily contrasts him with Dane Eidos.
Oh, Dane.
Dane is Violet's childhood best friend. He is a squad leader, a stickler for the rules, and the initial romantic interest.
There's a moment in Book One where Dane kisses her.
But the relationship disintegrates. And it's critical for trivia players to understand why. It's not just a standard love triangle where she picks the bad boy over the good guy.
No, the dissolution of Violet and Dane's relationship revolves around the ethics of magic and the concept of cognitive consent.
Cognitive consent, that's exactly it.
Because Dane's signet, allows him to read a person's recent memories, but it requires physical contact.
And Dane uses this power on Violet. He touches her face under the guise of affection, and without her consent, he extracts her memories to gather intelligence on Zaydan's movements.
Which he then feeds to Navarre's high command. He weaponizes her trust. He completely violates the sanctity of her own mind.
Contrast that betrayal with the central conflict between Violet and Zaganan in Book 2, Iron Flame. Their relationship fractures, but not over a violation of autonomy.
No, it fractures over a massive sin of omission.
Zaydan is hiding an explosive secret that could get him executed on the spot. He is an intrinsic.
A mind reader.
Yes. He has a secondary signet that allows him to read intentions and thoughts. Navarre's leadership views mind readers as an uncontrollable threat and strictly executes them upon discovery.
So Adadan burying this secret is just a matter of raw survival.
Right.
But to Violet, coming off the trauma of Dane violating her memories, discovering that Janin can also read minds, feels like another catastrophic betrayal of trust.
It's agonizing. Book two is just watching them painstakingly trying to rebuild their foundation of trust while the wards are failing and the Venan army is marching on the college.
Which culminates in the catastrophic tactical choices of book three, Onyx Storm. The political machinations fade away, and we are left with the raw consequences of the magic system.
The climactic battle takes place at Dreithis. The Venan have overwhelmed the defenses. Skal is grounded and taking lethal damage. Violet is completely expended.
The parameters of the battle dictate that they are going to die.
So Zaydan makes the impossible choice. We talked about the thermodynamic draw of Venan magic earlier, plugging your bare hands into the nuclear reactor. As Aiden watches the woman he loves and the dragon he has bonded to face execution, he bypasses Stale. He reaches into the earth.
Oh, it hurts to even talk about.
He draws the corrupted magic directly into his own body to save them. He becomes an Asim.
He intentionally infects himself with the Venan curse, unleashing a devastating wave of shadow magic, the Onyx Storm that obliterates the enemy forces.
And the psychological tragedy is immense. Aiden Rearson has defined his entire existence by his resistance to tyranny and corruption. He spent years building a network to fight the Venan.
And in one desperate moment, to save Violet, he voluntarily becomes the exact monster he sacrificed everything to destroy.
The corruption begins hollowing out his soul immediately.
And that leads directly into the jaw-dropping cliffhanger we opened with. Zaydan knows he's a danger to Violet now. The Venan magic will compel him to seek more power, to become a tyrant.
So before the corruption fully takes over, he orchestrates a wedding in Orisha, ensuring Violet is legally recognized as the Duchess of Tirindor.
Because this isn't just a romantic gesture, it is political armor. The title gives her massive legal and diplomatic protection against the Navarre leadership. And then he asks Imogen to wipe Violet's memory of the event so Dane or the generals can't extract the information from her mind, and he just vanishes into the wilderness to fight the Venan infection alone.
From a trivia perspective, knowing the mechanics of that sequence is essential. But let's pivot to a category of trivia that is uniquely prevalent at romanticy events.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
The statistical breakdown of the romance pacing. The spicy chapter index.
Oh, this is guaranteed to come up. The trivia host is absolutely going to ask you about the distribution of the explicit romance scenes, because Yaros uses them very deliberately to manage narrative tension.
You have to know the numbers.
So, listeners, group these numbers conceptually. Don't just try to memorize the digits blindly. In Book 1, Fourth Wing, it's a pure slow burn. The tension builds for hundreds of pages until it finally breaks in chapters 22, 30, and 32.
But chapter 30 is the epicenter of the Book 1 romance arc. Keep that in mind.
Right. In Book 2, Iron Flame, the frequency escalates as their emotional volatility increases. You are tracking chapters 12, 20, 27, 37, 48, and 60.
And the core progression happens in the sequence of 27, 37, and 48.
But the real trivia trap lies in the pacing of Book 3, Onyx Storm. Book 3 is 66 chapters long. The first two books had roughly 3 to 6 major romantic beats each.
Onyx Storm throws the slow burn entirely out the window.
It hits you with chapters 3, 11, 12, 18, 24, 25, 48, and 49. The trivia point here is the ratio.
Right.
Book 3 has 8 major spicy chapters, and they start almost immediately in chapter 3, signaling to the reader that this is a story driven by desperation, trauma bonding, and the terrifying realization that they might not survive the week.
Yeah, the pacing tells a story all its own. But while understanding the thematic weight of the romance will help you with the essay-style questions, the rapid-fire rounds of trivia rely heavily on exposing your memory of the world-building details.
Tricky stuff.
The naming conventions Yarrows employs are specifically designed to sound linguistically similar, which causes intense confusion under pressure.
Exactly. Let's enter the trivia cram phase. We really need to untangle these mix-ups. Let's start with the geographic traps. Pair number one, Areshia versus Athabine.
They sound almost identical if a host reads them quickly.
Areshia and Athabine. So how do we tell them apart?
The key is identifying their function. Areshia is a massive, ancient city located in the province of Tirindor. It is the ancestral home of the Ryerson family and serves as the fortified headquarters for the rebellion.
Areshia is a living, breathing metropolis.
Yes. Athabine, on the other hand, is barely a footnote on a map. It is a remote, heavily fortified military outpost located just beyond the edge of Navarre's magical wards.
It only exists to serve as a staging ground for the cadets' war games in Book 1.
Exactly. Areshia is the rebel capital. Athabine is a border outpost.
Pair number two, Ryerson versus Drathus. Again, two locations with heavy casualties, so readers blur them together all the time.
Both are settlements in the neighboring nation of Coromiel, which is why they are linked in the mind. But you must separate them chronologically by the books.
Right.
Ryerson is the small Poromish trading town from the climax of Book 1. It is where Violet first witnesses the reality of the Venon, and it is where Liam dies.
Book 1 tragedy.
Drathus is a major Poromish city. It is the setting for the apocalyptic climax of Book 3, where the Venon melt their massive siege and where Exodin makes the choice to draw from the earth.
So Ryerson equals Book 1 tragedy. Drathus equals Book 3 tragedy. Easy enough.
Let's move to the dragons, because the hosts love to test you on tail types. Dragon combat tactics dictate a lot of the aerial battles. We need to distinguish between Day and Calf.
Both are red dragons, so color won't save you here.
You must identify the physical morphology of the tail, as it dictates the dragon's fighting style. Day, who was bonded to the tragic figure of Liam Merry, was a red dagger tail.
Dagger tails.
Yeah. They're built for precision strikes in close quarters aerial combat. Cath, who is bonded to the antagonist Dane Eidos, is a red sword tail.
Sword tails use sweeping, heavy impact blows.
Exactly. If the question specifies a red dagger tail, lock in Liam. If it specifies a red sword tail, lock in Dane.
Got it. Let's quickly review the terminology mix-ups. Signet versus relic versus rebellion relic.
Okay, a signet is not a physical object. It is the invisible, internal, magical ability channeled from the dragon, such as Violet's lightning or Azaden's shadows.
Right.
A relic is the standard, permanent mark that every single rider receives on their skin upon successfully bonding a dragon.
And the rebellion relic.
The rebellion relic is a highly specific, unique mark. It is the shimmering, twisting tattoo placed solely on the 107 children of the executed rebel officers by General Melgrin's dragon, Coda.
Let's run through some character confusion. Lilith versus Melgrin. Both are older, high-ranking military leaders in Navarre, which is why people mix them up in the heat of the moment.
The distinction is their fate and their function. General Lilith Sorengale is Violet's mother. She is a storm wielder, and she is dead.
Spoiler alert again.
Right. During the climax of Book 2, Iron Flame, she sacrifices herself, using a cadet's siphon ability to drain her own life force into the Wardstone to reactivate Navarre's defenses.
And General Melgrin.
General Melgrin is the supreme commanding general of the forces, the man with the precognition signet, and he is very much alive and actively trying to manage the fallout of the failing wards.
How about Eric versus Haldin? This requires a deep dive into the political succession of Navarre.
This is a royal family dispute. Eric is an alias. He is a cadet currently hiding within the brutal conditions of the Riders Quadrant under a false surname.
But his true identity is Prince Kemlane Eric Tauri.
Right, the third son of King Tauri. He joined the Riders to escape his father's control and uncover the truth.
And Haldin is his older brother, the heir apparent to the throne.
Exactly. Haldin represents the continuation of the corrupt regime, while Eric represents a potential disruption to the monarchy from within the military.
Next up on the mix-up list, Jack Barlow versus Dane Eidos. They are the two primary antagonists for Violet in the early books, but they represent entirely different threats.
Jack Barlow is a threat of physical violence. He is a massive, sadistic cadet who actively tries to murder Violet on multiple occasions in Book 1.
Violet eventually retaliates by literally dropping a stone turret on him with her lightning.
However, he survives, and the massive reveal in Book 2 is that Jack survived because he had secretly turned Venon.
He used earth magic to heal himself.
Yep, before ultimately destroying the Wardstone from the inside.
And Dane Eidos.
Dane Eidos, conversely, is a threat of psychological violation. He doesn't want to kill Violet. He wants to control her. He betrays her by extracting her memories. Jack attacks her body. Dane attacks her mind.
That's a great way to remember it. You also need to have a firm grip on the chronological milestones of a cadet's first year at Beskyd Yith. The timeline is super rigid. Think of it in four steps. Parapet, gauntlet, threshing, presentation.
The parapet is the physical entry requirement. It's the rain-slicked bridge crossing on day one. You survive the crossing. You are admitted to the college.
Then the gauntlet.
The gauntlet happens weeks later. It is a grueling vertical obstacle course designed to test physical strength, agility, and problem solving under extreme duress. You must pass the gauntlet to be deemed worthy of facing a dragon.
And that leads to threshing.
Threshing is the actual event where the dragons evaluate the cadets and decide who to bond or who to incinerate.
And finally, presentation.
Presentation is the formal military ceremony that occurs after threshing, where the surviving, newly bonded riders are officially presented to the leadership hierarchy.
All right, I have a massive red flag to wave for everyone listening right now. Trivia hosts love to exploit book talk trends and fan theories to make you lose points.
Oh, they absolutely do.
If a question pops up asking you to define the romantic relationship between Exaden's second-in-command, Garrick, and Violet's older sister, Mira, what do you write down?
You write down that it is unconfirmed.
Unconfirmed.
The fan community aggressively ships Garrick and Mira because they share a few tense interactions that readers interpret as hidden chemistry. However, canonically, within the text of the first three books, there is zero confirmation of a romantic relationship.
Do not let internet theories override the actual text. The text is king.
Always.
Now let's grab the easiest points on the board. The real-world publication trivia. The architect of our suffering is author Rebecca Yarros. The series umbrella is titled The Empyrean. And how many books are we buckling up for?
The series is contracted for 5 books total. It is worth noting that it was originally conceptualized as a trilogy, but the complexity of the world building necessitated an expansion.
Let's run the release dates. Fourth Wing dropped on May 2nd, 2023, and fundamentally altered the Romandacy landscape. Iron Flame followed at a breakneck pace on November 7th, 2023. Onyx Storm hit the shelves on January 21st, 2025. Now, here is a curveball. What is the deal with the companion book?
The companion book is a highly specific trivia point. It is titled Threshing Day. It is a collection of 13 short stories detailing the experiences of secondary characters during their respective threshing ceremonies.
Wow.
It is scheduled for release on September 29th, 2026. Within the fandom, it is strictly referred to as a companion project, not book 4.
Which means if the trivia host, with a sly smile, asks you to name the title or the release date of book 4.
You're being set up. As of this moment, book 4 has no official title and no confirmed release date. The author has stated publicly that the plotting phase began in February 2026. Any date offered as a definitive answer is a fabrication.
The same exact trap applies to the television adaptation. We know Prime Video acquired the rights. We know they officially ordered it to series in May 2026.
Right.
We even know the behind-the-camera talent. Meredith Averill, known for her phenomenal work on The Haunting of Hill House, is the showrunner. Lisa Joy, one of the brilliant minds behind Westworld and Fallout, is directing the pilot. But if the question asks who has been cast to play Violet Soaringale or Zayden Riorson,
you write down that no cast has been announced. The internet is flooded with fan castings and rumors, but no official studio announcements have been made. Stick to the verified facts.
Okay, I have one final, incredibly dense lore question to test you with. I'm sitting at the trivia table, and a question asks me to identify the 7th breed of dragon. My instinct is to just write down black dragon because Taren is so prominent. How do I navigate this?
Writing down black dragon will cost you the point. This question targets the deepest lore surrounding Violet's second dragon, Andarna.
Ah, Andarna.
When Andarna is a hatchling, she has golden scales. As she matures, her scales begin to shift and darken, leading many to assume she is simply growing into a black dragon like Taren.
That's not true.
No, the monumental reveal is that Andarna possesses a camouflage ability. She is not a black dragon. She's the last surviving member of a lost ancient 7th breed known as an Irid.
An Irid?
Yes. Jasenia, the brilliant scribe, translates ancient texts that reveal the massive magical wards protecting Navarre were fundamentally flawed. They were powered by the magic of 6 dragon breeds, but the ancient magic actually required the harmonious power of all 7 breeds to achieve full strength.
So Andarna was the missing piece.
Exactly. Andarna, as the sole living Irid, was the missing variable. Her unique magic was the only thing that allowed them to successfully repair and fully power Navarre's failing defenses.
That is exactly the level of deep-cut knowledge that wins the night. You guys, we have covered an immense amount of tactical ground today. You now have the complete architectural blueprint of the Empyrean universe.
You are ready.
You don't just know that Venan draw magic from the Earth. You understand the thermodynamic and psychological corruption of that act. You don't just know that General Melgrin is blind to the Marked Ones. You understand how Kodaa's rebellion relic acts as a localized radar jammer.
You grasp the tragic, biologically enforced proximity of Violet and Zayden's romance, culminating in the devastating tactical choice at Dreithis and the clandestine memory-wiped wedding.
And you are bulletproof against the geographical and character mix-ups that trip up the casual fans. You are walking into that pub as a heavily armed scribe.
The foundational knowledge is secure. The challenge now is maintaining your composure and recalling the specifics when the clock is ticking.
But before you head out to claim your victory, I want to leave you with one final provocative theory to dissect with your team before round one begins.
Let's hear it.
We spent a significant amount of time discussing the immutable laws of magic in this universe. Specifically, the rule that Venan magic is a one-way street.
Right, the corruption.
The lore established by Navarre dictates that once you channel from the Earth, as Zayden did, your soul is irrevocably corrupted. There is no cure. There is no coming back.
That is the accepted scientific and magical consensus of their society, yes.
But is it actually the truth? Look at the evidence we've accumulated. The entire history of Navarre is built on centuries of meticulously crafted lies. They lied about the Venan existing. They lied about Poromael being the enemy. They lied about the wars.
They lied about almost everything.
So why should we believe their medical assessment of the Venan curse? Consider the two massive secret weapons Violet currently holds. First, she has a secondary signet that she is hiding from everyone. Dreamwalking.
Which is a huge deal.
This is a profound form of mind magic, a discipline so feared by Navarre that they execute anyone who displays it. Second, she is bonded to Andarna, the ancient Losk Ire dragon, whose unique magic was the singular key to doing the impossible task of repairing the wards.
You are suggesting a synthesis of unknown variables.
I'm suggesting that if Navarre's textbooks are full of lies, the concept of irreversible is just another lie. If you combine Violet's forbidden, uncharted mind magic with the ancient foundational magic of the Irid breed, could that be the formula? Could Violet possess the exact, unprecedented magical frequency required to reach into Vazen's corrupted hardware and reverse the Venan curse in Book 4?
It forces us to question whether the Venan state is a permanent biological mutation or simply a deeply entrenched magical parasite that can be starved or extracted by a stronger, purer source of power. It is a highly compelling tactical hypothesis.
I'll let you debate the mechanics of that theory over your first round of drinks. Just remember your training when you sit down at that table. The questions will be designed to confuse you, the pressure will mount, and it might feel exactly like taking that first terrifying step onto the slippery stones of the parapet.
It definitely will.
The wind is howling, and the drop is lethal. But you understand the physics of the bridge now. Keep your wards fully powered, keep your dragons close, and whatever you do, don't look down.